You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you so much for joining us. Lauren Groff's 2015 novel, Fates and Furies, took a close look at a single marriage from what turns out to be two radically different perspectives of the husband and the wife. The book, along with being a favorite of President Obama's, was one of the most talked about books that year and was a finalist for the National Book Award and the National Book Critics Award. Her latest work, Florida, is a collection of short stories. It looks at the mysterious and hidden corners of the state and the people who live there. The book was once again one of the most anticipated of the year and was published in July to wide acclaim. And it's a finalist for the National Book Award. She's good at that. Tonight, you can catch Lauren Groff at Symphony Space at 7:30 for the Riverhead Books 25th Anniversary Edition of Selected Shorts. She'll be there along with James McBride, Daniel Alarcon, and Meg Walzer, who was here in the studio on Monday. But right now in the studio is Lauren Groff. Welcome to All of It.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So I was reading interviews and listening to past interviews from the Fates and Furies time, and it was really interesting. There was this one line, you answered somebody and you said, you wrote the book because you were coming to terms with what you really felt about marriage. So I'm not going to ask you about that, but I'm going to ask you, what was it in this collection that you were feeling, that you felt like, I need to write about Florida, I need to write about the nooks, the crannies, all the weirdness, and some of the wonderfulness?
Well, Florida to me is not just a geographical state. It's also a state of mind, and it's a state of dread in a lot of ways. I have incredibly intense feelings about climate change, and especially as the mother of two small children, right? There's a morality and a difficulty in seeing their future in terms of climate change. And so and Florida is the most beautiful state. It is an incredibly vulnerable state to climate change. And I was feeling very, very vulnerable in not only these stories, but also, you know, in my psyche at the time when I was writing this book.
It's interesting you should say that, because I have interviewed Carl Hiaasen. And two things he said about Florida. One is all the crazy stuff that's in his novels, or he just rips out of newspaper headlines. That stuff happens. And two, he as well is an environmentalist and is incredibly concerned about the overdevelopment and what's happening to the natural state of Florida. You know, I'm wondering, are you alone in that? Or do Floridians care about that?
Oh, there are so many amazing Floridians. I mean, I know we went through a terrible, bruising, awful election recently.
That's what made me ask.
I know. And it was really, really heartbreaking, because there are so many incredible Floridians who are working really, really hard to make the world better. Honestly, turn Florida blue. Mm-hmm. And it was devastating to see what had happened. But there are many environmentalists in Florida. I'm not alone. And Carl and I are not just sitting there, this little cabal of two, thinking about the environment, right? Like going on the beach and picking up plastic baggies. There are many people working for change. But I think we need to have a groundswell. We need to actually change all of the politicians and make them actually believe in climate change.
You wrote this amazing novel, and now you have the series of short stories. Tell me about the pros of writing short stories versus a novel.
Well, the pros, I think, in both should probably be really taught. It should carry a lot of weight, a lot of emotional levels. But I think that the difference for me is in how I write novels versus how I write short stories. And how I write a short story is I just let it sort of marinate in the back of my head for as many years as it takes. And then one day I will read something, or I'll talk to someone, or I'll get really excited about an idea or an image, and the story will spark into life and I won't be able to see anything but the story. And then I try to sit down and write the story at one sitting, because I do believe that the energy of a short story has to be the same, or has to push outward like waves toward the shore. With a novel, you wake up with it every day. It's, you know, a beloved institution in which you live. And everything that you do throughout the day, even if you're not actively writing the novel, has an effect on what the novel is. And so it's more about living within a space, and the short story is being possessed by the story in some ways.
You gave me the sprint versus marathon.
Exactly,
right?
But I didn't want to say that.
Okay, I'll use the cliche. That's my job. You're the lovely writer. I'll be the cliche machine. But it's interesting, in the short story, I really enjoyed, I mean, I love a good long novel, but I really enjoyed following particularly one character of Jude in one of the short stories, and you meet him when he's little, and you go through his whole life in this short story versus Nothing Against the Goldfinch. I loved that book. But you have to live through the torture of that child's childhood for hundreds of pages. But there was something sort of satisfying to me as a reader about knowing Jude's whole life.
The amazing thing about short stories is that you can do anything in them. You can use your canvas as a sort of a broad canvas, or you can go really, really tight and do, you know, paint angels on a piece of rice, right? I mean, you can do anything you want to. And I do love the really long, languorous feeling of seeing a whole life, but trying to condense it into maybe 20 pages. I think it's really exciting, and it gives the story an extra level, you know, if you can see the whole life by the end of it.
Speaking with Lauren Groff about her series of short stories called Florida, I have to ask the obvious question. So for listeners who haven't read the book yet, why is it called Florida? A series of short stories. Are they all, they're all in Florida, Florida infused? Explain to folks.
Yeah, they're all infused by Florida in certain ways. There's a certain recurring character throughout five of the stories who is not me, but she's not me. She's like an intensified, condensed version of me. And she is a transplant to Florida, and she is from the Northeast, not unlike me. And it's a, you know, Florida is an incredibly strange place. It's I have yet to become accustomed to it. I mean, any place where lizards live inside your house without your permission is, is going to be a strange place. It's going to be unusual. And, you know, we've got palmetto bugs, which are flying cockroaches that are 3 inches long. They're pretty gross. You know, a place where you can't let your little dog near retention ponds or else alligators are going to get them. So there's always something a little bit spiky, a little bit dangerous, a little bit dark underneath the sunshine of Florida.
It's in the New Yorker described it as you explore the psychogeography.
I love it.
Of Florida.
Yes.
So how do you define psychogeography? I know exactly what they mean. When you read it, you know what they mean. But what do you think that means?
I don't know. I think she was talking about maybe situationists and Guy Debord and everything. I'm not sure. But I do think it's that there's a psychic geography that one lives within when one lives in a space. I mean, you live here. In this amazing metropolis. Mm-hmm. And I think it really profoundly affects the way that you see the world and the way that you see the people around you, right? And if I were to live as a hermit on the top of a mountain, the way that I would see the world would be radically different from who I am in Florida. So I do believe that our landscape changes personality and changes the way that we see the world. And so having this dangerous place, this almost lush, beautiful, golden, and green, yet hidden, mysterious place that has an effect upon my characters' psyches.
And it's how they move through the world.
It is.
It affects how they move through the world.
Yes, it does, for real.
And some of the different choices they make. I'm going to ask you to read something because there's a lot. You mentioned the palmetto bugs. There's a lot of references to snakes in this book. So many snakes. Do you mind reading the first page of Snake Stories at page 204?
Sure. And I just want to say, because someone yelled at me about this, this story is playing a lot with the Adam and Eve story, so snakes are necessary to it. Okay. Snake Stories. Babe, when Satan tempted Adam and Eve, there's a pretty good reason he didn't transform into a talking clam. It was my husband who said this to me. This statement of his has begun to seem both ludicrous and dangerous, like the 3-foot rat snake my younger son almost stepped on in the street yesterday, thinking it a stick. Walk outside in Florida and a snake will be watching you. Snakes in mulch, snakes in scrub, snakes waiting from the lawn for you to leave the pool so they can drown themselves in it. Snakes gazing at your mousy ankle and wondering what it would feel like to sink their fangs in deep.
So it's interesting. I mean, it's practical. You talk about snakes and kids bringing snakes into the house and all of this. But, you know, you could have done that about palmetto bugs. Why snakes?
Well, because this is a story talking about the way men and women are together. And the way that perhaps even in the Bible, there was this expectation set up of domination. And this story, I've been thinking about it for probably 6 years. I only wrote it about 2 years ago. And it, you know, in some ways I wrote it before Me Too. I don't want to give it away, but it does, it talks a lot about the things that are going on right now and how even good men, if they're not paying attention, can be bad men.
I'm going to go back to being the cliche machine.
No, I love it.
Okay.
Go for it.
So, you know, there's so many cliches about the state, about Florida. It's God's waiting room. That's one, right? The country's on a slope and all the strange folks slid into Florida. At the top of the state is Floribama. That's the gators everywhere. That's actually true.
Yes.
Of all the cliches, which ones did you find as a transplant are true? And which ones prove to be rich for you as a writer?
They're all a little bit true, but they're all also incredibly contradictory in a lot of ways, too. So, yes, a lot of strange stuff does happen in Florida, but that has come to define Florida instead of being a small part of Florida. And in fact, if you were to look at New Jersey, I don't think it would be much different in terms of the weirdness coming out of there.
Oh, no. I'm a Jersey girl, and I can say, yes, that's true.
I love New Jersey. It's great. but I think in some ways, we are the butt of the joke. I just physically, we hang off the country. You know, it's really sad.
People get mad and say, snap it off, instead of the float. You know, you've heard them all.
Yeah,
yet I'm probably going there in 6 weeks and I'm happy about it.
Yeah, exactly. It's a wonderful state. It's a monkey bread state. I mean, there's no single story of Florida. There are millions of different stories. Even our geography is profoundly different. I mean, where I live in Gainesville, it's the swamp. I mean, we have a ton of heritage oaks. It's very beautiful, but it feels very much like Georgia, southern Georgia. You go 90 miles either to the Gulf or to the Atlantic, they're radically different environments and landscapes. Radically different people choose to live in these different landscapes. And the landscape has a profound effect on who they are as people as they live there, too. So I am very wary of the urge to make Florida seem to be a unified object when, in fact, it is it's profoundly weird because it contradicts itself all the time, all over the place.
And how much of it being so full of transplants is a part of that?
Like me, I think there are 64% of the people who live in Florida are not from Florida. My husband is a person who is from Florida, and he's the strange one, right? He's
unusual. Floridian,
He's a real Floridian. And I do think, you know, if you're coming to the end of your life and you have some money to spend, you're going to spend it in silly ways, possibly, right? And that's a cliche that comes from the God's waiting room idea. Mm-hmm. I don't have any idea how much of it is. It comes from people coming to Florida and then going crazy. I think probably, you know, Daytona Beach and Spring Breakers have given the state a lot of the cliches that we think about it, but. I don't know. What I would love to do is make our conception of the state more complicated and more meaningful.
What were your book events like in Florida?
Oh, they were lovely. They were so good. Except I have to say, the very first event I did, it was in Books and Books in Coral Gables, which is an interesting place.
Yeah.
I love it. And Books and Books is a great bookstore. But this woman angrily raises her hand and says, "You write a lot about snakes, but I have lived in Florida all my life and I've never seen a snake." And everyone turned and looked at her in the room. And I said, "Oh, well, have you ever gone outside?" Right? Because everybody else in the room thought that was a very strange thing for her to say. And I think that what I was trying to do in this book is to give a multiplicity of stories about this one place that we think that we know. Right. And maybe her truth, that is her truth. And it's true for her. But that's not the truth for the rest of the people in the room.
We're speaking with Lauren Groff about her new book of short stories called Florida. Stay with us. We'll talk to Lauren a little bit more. Can we talk a little bit about process and writing and weird questions you get and the great answers you give?
Yeah.
Okay. That's coming up after the break. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. Lauren and I just talked through the whole break, the whole thing. Your writing process, I'm curious, do you have an office? Do you go sit and write? I know you have small children at home. They are like homing pigeons. They can find you in the house if you're trying to work. Where do you work? How do you work?
Well, no, I've scared the bejesus out of my children. Like, they know not to bother me. So I actually had, I was angry that my husband made me move to Florida 13 years ago. And so I made him sign a contract, and this is pre-children, that laid out everything that I got for having to move to Florida. And I actually tell this to my graduate students sometimes, just to say that it's not a bad idea, because it staves off a lot of resentment, because mothers are required to do things that they didn't know that they were getting into.
Oh, yes.
And so one of the things that I made him agree to before we had children was that he would wake up with the children and he would get them ready for school. And then he would take them to school and I wouldn't have to see anyone in the morning, which has been my saving grace. Because I get up at 5 in the morning, I'm still dreaming. I go get a cup of coffee. I run upstairs and I get started. And nobody even wakes up for the next hour and a half. And I have my earphones on, so I wouldn't hear them anyway. And I can just work through the chaos of the morning. Primarily because as soon as that first little voice gets into your head, it's all over, right? You can't concentrate. You can't focus. And the neediness can keep you away from the neediness of the work. I think my theory was that my work was my first child, and I wasn't going to starve my first child in order to feed my actual living flesh children.
How long did it take you to write this book, Florida?
So the first story was published in Subtropics in, I would love to say, 2009. So 9 years, 8 years. Yeah.
That's so, now did you go back and look at it?
Oh, yeah.
Over time, like after you think, oh, I've done it in my book, and then I go back and I read that first story again, and I think, wow, so think about how much has changed since 2009.
So much has changed since 2009. Yeah, I even read my own audiobook, and reading, that was a surreal experience, because it was reading the ghost of myself 9 years ago. You know, it was very unusual. I can tell sort of the trajectory of personality through these stories, but they're not laid out in terms of timeline. They're laid out in terms of subterranean theme and ideas and imagery that speaks from one story to another. So I can trace the development of myself as a writer. I hope the reader would not be able to.
Mm-hmm. All right. So the question, the tease I gave was, there was this great, for Harvard Gazette, this reporter asked you, and I'm going to read it. You are a mother of two. In 10 years, you have produced 3 novels and 2 short story collections. Can you talk about your process and how you manage work and family? And your answer was, I understand this is a question of vital importance to many people, particularly to other mothers who are artists trying to get their work done, and know that I feel for everyone the struggle. But until I see a male writer ask this question, I'm going to respectfully decline to answer it. That blew up Twitter.
Yeah.
If you hashtag Lauren Groff, that is still what comes up, because I tried it this morning.
I just proved myself a hypocrite because I just talked about it. So, you know.
Well, not really. I asked you about specifically about how your writing process.
That's true.
You as your full person sort of volunteered children.
That's true. Thank you. Thank you for not asking the other question. So that that answer actually was one that I've been responding with for probably 5-6 years now. Mm-hmm. And that was the only time it has ever blown up. And I don't know why exactly it did there, but it is true. I've been on panels with, you know, 4 male writers and me, and I'm the one who gets the how do you balance domesticity and child rearing, you know, domesticity and mm-hmm. book writing. And I get so frustrated. It's so frustrating. It's so frustrating because if I'm on a panel, I'm there as a writer. I'm not there as a mother. And why are men never asked these questions? Why do we let them off the hook? Mm-hmm. Why do we not make them do 50%+ of the work also? You know, I just don't. I've had enough.
When I used to travel for work as a reporter, sometimes people are like, well, who was home with your children? And I just would say, oh, I left them with a remote and a book of matches.
Yeah.
Like, of course there's somebody watching my show. It made me crazy that there was somehow, there was this inference that, who's watching him?
I always say I emptied out a cereal container on the kitchen table and they can sort of fend for themselves.
I did want to ask you about your book covers, because Meg Walters also talked about the sort of the subtle sexism of art direction in books. And you have this particular font you use, and your books are, I wouldn't call them male or female. I would just call the covers covers. Same with hers. These are these bright geometrics. Is that something that you have paid attention to and have weighed in on?
Oh, my gosh. Absolutely. And I have to say, I adore Riverhead for many, many reasons. But one of the reasons is they are geniuses at covers. I mean, the covers that you remember are Riverhead covers. And that's in large part due to the art director, Helen Yentes, mm-hmm. who's brilliant. But also, it's because they are committed to sort of subtly change the way that we think about gender and many other things in publishing. I mean, that's one of their MOs. And I think it's really, they're committed to it. They're really good at doing that sort of thing. No, my first, I haven't liked many of my covers worldwide until I got to Riverhead.
Oh, that's interesting. And it's also sort of I hope this isn't a fan, like a brand. Like this is the Lauren.
Kind of.
This is the Lauren Groff font to
but
me.
But I have to say, so many books are coming out with it now that I feel like it's not mine
that's
anymore.
Interesting.
It's not mine anymore.
Before I let you go, you believe deeply in reading. You know, a lot of writers, I think that you know they think, or civilians think writers all they do is write. You read all the time. Why is reading so important to you as a writer?
I'm mostly a reader. I'm probably 93% a reader and 7% a writer. And it's because my whole vision of what I'm doing is not just what I'm doing at the moment. It's speaking, trying to speak to people of the past, speaking to their souls that are sort of encapsulated in these paper codices. But also I'm trying to speak to people in the future, right? And so I need to have as many ideas, as many images, as many different ways of telling narrative inside of me when I go to sit down and tell my own stories that I possibly can. I need to steal things from poets because poets are the geniuses of the literary world. I need to have facts from nonfiction writers. You know, it's pleasure, and it's the reason why I went into writing was to connect like this. And it's my job. It's my job to read.
What are a couple of things you're reading or you think people should read?
So Helen Oyeyemi is coming out with a book, and she's one of the great, brilliant writers. It's called Gingerbread. And I'm in the middle of Yuki Mishima's tetralogy. It's called The Sea of Fertility, and it's really beautiful and very strange. I'm sort of into these large, multi-book series right now. Hmm. Eleanor Fronte, Anthony Powell, you know, obviously there's Proust. I haven't quite gotten all the way through yet. I will someday, but you know, there's something about that feeds the same itch we get when we binge watch things on Netflix.
I call binge reading. That's why I think those giant books, they're binge reading books.
Yes.
What's going to happen tonight in Symphony Space?
Oh, it's a celebration of Riverhead. So there are so many brilliant writers who are presenting their stories, and we have the most incredible actors reading these stories. It's going to be incredible.
Well, have an amazing night. It sounds like a terrific celebration. It was lovely to meet you, Lauren Groff.
It was great to meet you. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on All of It. Title IX, it's in the news a lot. When Education Secretary Betsy DeVos proposed an overhaul of how colleges handle sexual assault accusations last week, she said the rules would make the process more, quote, fair. Here she is last year explaining the Trump administration's philosophy on the issue.
Every survivor of sexual misconduct must be taken seriously. Every student accused of sexual misconduct must know that guilt is not predetermined.
The revised rules have drawn sharp criticism from victim advocacy groups, including survivor and victims' rights advocate Morgan McCall.
It seems to put the safety and the well-being of survivors of sexual assault, of complainants, on the back burner, and that is extremely problematic to me.
It's all part of the Trump administration's efforts to redefine Title IX, the federal law that requires schools to appropriately respond to reports of sexual harassment and sexual assault against students. Here to explain the changes and give us some insight into the evolution of Title IX is Erin Buzovis. She's a professor at Western New England School of Law. She's also the director of the school's Center for Gender and Sexuality Studies. Erin, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So in 1972, President Nixon signs this into law, this federal civil rights law. I want you to help us understand what was happening before 1972 that made Title IX necessary.
Yeah. Well, you know, most people, at least before the current era, have associated Title IX with sports. And so I think people are often surprised to hear that the types of discrimination that precipitated the law's passage really had to do with discrimination in admissions. A number of colleges and universities in the United States had quotas, caps, effectively, on women's admission, you know, ensuring that the majority of seats in a given incoming class would go to men as presumed future breadwinners. The bias against female students was that they were just there for a, quote, MRS degree, mm-hmm. And weren't really there to take full serious opportunity to engage in an academic opportunity. So this was hamstringing women's education. It also, relatedly, there was discrimination in employment within education. So female applicants to positions in higher education were also experiencing discrimination. And so activists were really rallying around that kind of discrimination and used those examples to get the law passed in 1972.
And also, when I think of Title IX, it's the name of a sportswear company where I buy a lot of my workout clothes. It has to do with sports as well, right?
Well, so that's because the language that Congress used when they passed the statute is very broad in the sense that what's prohibited is sex discrimination in the context of education. It doesn't specify, the statute itself doesn't specify or limit, you know, very much the type of discrimination that's covered. There are some particular exceptions, but, you know, by and large, it's just generally a ban on discrimination. And then as a matter of regulatory enforcement, we have a set of regulations promulgated by the Department of Education's predecessor agency that explains all the different various contexts in which Title IX applies, everything from employment-related issues to issues involving discrimination against students and employees on the basis of their pregnancy, the discrimination in the context of facilities. And then, of course, one aspect of education is athletics, and so that is naturally covered as well. It's just that the application of Title IX to athletics has been really much more visible than many of the other applications of Title IX to date. I mean, the stuff about admissions, as soon as the law was passed, there really wasn't much controversy or challenge after that. Title IX fairly effectively solved the problem of ending quotas in graduate school admissions. But it was a much bigger challenge to end discrimination in athletics, and that's been such a more long-term and ongoing and entrenched problem that a lot of Title IX's visibility has been around that.
All right, so the past 46 years we've had President Ford for a second, President Carter, President Reagan, President Bush, President Clinton, Bush II, Obama, and Trump. During the course of these administrations, were any of these administrations, did they do anything specific that either challenged, changed, altered, or had any effect on Title IX?
Yeah. No, there really have been noticeable differences in Title IX enforcement depending on the presidential administration of the time. Sort of notoriously in the Reagan-Bush era, the Department of Education had a much more laissez-faire attitude about regulation and enforcement in general, and so there wasn't as much enforcement going on in those under those administrations. There have been efforts. There was efforts during the second President Bush to try to weaken Title IX after engaging with some findings from a particular presidential commission that was established that would have tried to modify some of the applications to athletics, but those were ultimately rolled back by the incoming Obama administration. And the Obama administration, of course, I know this is where the conversation is headed, has been the most visible in terms of expanding the regulatory clarifications around application to sexual assault. Although I should be clear that the Obama administration was not by any means the first administration to start to raise awareness around compliance obligations in that area. They just did it in a more detailed way than had been earlier attempted.
So when was it earlier attempted?
There were earlier versions of the 2011 Dear Colleague letter in like 2001 and 2006. The reason for multiple rounds of interpretation, and this isn't unique to Title IX's feature, to the feature of Title IX that applies to schools' response to sexual misconduct, but the way regulation and enforcement works generally is that, you know, you might have a statute that's pretty general, as Title IX is. Not a lot of detail on what it means to say no discrimination in education. And then an agency will set regulations and do it in a very prescribed manner. In fact, I think we're going to talk about that process a little later because it's coming up again now. And the regulations that come out of this particular prescribed process, I mean, they end up being not exactly set in stone, but having a lot more stability and staying power. But also might create questions of interpretation, and maybe the regulations don't cover every situation or don't provide a lot of detail on every on every situation that the regulations might apply to. And so an agency might decide, well, let's offer entities that have to comply with these regulations the benefit of some additional clarity, and might decide to publish guidance documents, as the agency has done over the years, and say, okay, so here's this regulatory requirement in Title IX that says schools have to engage in a, quote, prompt and equitable response to sexual harassment when it occurs. And sexual harassment, of course, includes, you know, everything from severe and pervasive, you know, verbal harassment to single instances of something, that's much more serious, like sexual assault or rape. And so a school has to engage in a, quote, prompt and equitable response. Well, what does that really mean? What does it mean to be prompt? You know, do we need to specify a particular timeline? You know, what does it mean to be equitable? Well, here are some of the things. So over the years, the Department of Education has offered increasingly detailed clarification around what that prompt and equitable requirement means. And of course, 2011 was the most recent, until the current administration, I guess, the most recent example of taking the opportunity of that process to clarify schools' response specifically to the kinds of sexual harassment that would be considered sexual assault or campus rape.
We're speaking with Professor Erin Boussouvis. She's the director of the Center for Gender and Sexual Studies at Western New England School of Law. So thank you so much for giving us, that's sort of the past of Title IX. I want to talk about what's going on in the present right now, the proposed changes. What are the specific changes Secretary DeVos and the administration are proposing on how colleges should handle sexual assault allegations?
Yeah. So the agency announced last week that it's going to propose new regulations. So this is going back to that idea of creating new regulations that'll be the version of regulatory law that's sort of more stable and set in stone, and not like these interpretations that we've seen more recently that can change with administration to administration. So what the administration is banking on here is that by making a change at the level of regulation instead of a interpretive policy or clarification, that these will be around for much longer and will endure changes in the political administration going forward. But specifically to your question, what the content of this proposal would do is, I mean, there are a number of different components of it, but I think maybe the one that most people are talking and concerned about is the requirements that would essentially judicialize campus processes for determining whether a student who's been reported to have engaged in sexual misconduct is actually responsible for that conduct and what kind of punishment might incur as a result. So what had been permitted up until the current administration was a much more flexible approach where schools could choose to have things that looked like a trial if they wanted to. But schools could also have the flexibility to engage in a more, I don't know, you know, in a less judicialized kind of proceeding, one where information from the parties involved might be gathered by an investigator, and the response to the information that the investigator gathered would be sort of the testimony would be given like on paper, and would have the people would have the opportunity to participate, but not necessarily live and in front of each other and in front of the fact finder. And the prior administration said, you can have a lot of flexibility to determine what kind of process you have, as long as a matter of Title IX, you're offering equitable opportunities to both the complainant and the respondent. In other words, the person who is reporting misconduct and the person who is being accused. So the prior administration didn't say you have to have a hearing. They just said if you do have a hearing, both parties have to participate. Or they didn't say you have to give a right to appeal, but if you do give a right to appeal, both parties have to have that right. So what we're actually seeing is a much more detailed set of requirements that's removing some of that discretion that used to exist under the old guidelines and standardizing this process that's much more judicialized. So requiring schools to have a live hearing where both parties participate and where the respondent has a right to cross-examine the complainant live and in front of the fact finder. Rights to discovery, you know, lawyers are going to be involved. This is the kind of change that is, I think, the most attention-grabbing from the current set of regulations.
What is concerning victim advocacy groups?
Yeah. So the concern there is that these features of a judicialized proceeding are going to deter reporting. I mean, I've read some experts estimating up to 50% drop in reporting. And the reason is because if somebody who has already gone through something, traumatic and uncomfortable, to say the least, has to engage in a lengthy process, a process that requires live participation, a process that requires potentially an interaction with the person that they're accusing, that people are going to say, this is too hard. You know, why bother to go through this? It's easier for me to just stay quiet and deal with this on my own.
There's a big New York Times op-ed about this yesterday, and in the op-ed, it was suggested that part of this is to get schools off the hook, and that there was some sort of loopholeable language that schools have to have, quote, actual knowledge and show deliberate indifference. So what are your thoughts on the proposed change in language?
I think that is. In fact, a concern. So, I know for a fact that there are a lot of well-intentioned college administrators who, especially in the, era of the 2011 Dear Colleague letter, have really embraced the spirit of that letter and taken this issue to heart and will continue to respond to, all kinds of sexual misconduct and do more than the law requires. But the concern that I have is that without a legal requirement to respond, then there won't be a mechanism for accountability, and that schools might decide, you know, maybe these well-meaning people that I'm so fond of now, you know, leave and are replaced by others, or maybe it's easy to say, you know, we're going to voluntarily do more than the law requires until the person who's accused is your star quarterback or, you know, someone who it would be difficult publicly to, you know, to when there would be public ramifications for bringing grievance proceeding against.
Okay. So 30 more seconds, but I want to ask you this one more last important question, though. This is a comment period. They've been talking about, Secretary DeVos has been talking about, this is a comment period and people can comment. Where do people go to comment?
Right. So you can find more information about that at regulations.gov. That's a sort of a standard clearinghouse website for all kinds of regulatory action. Technically, the proposal isn't being published until tomorrow. And when that publication occurs, there will be specific instructions in the proposal about the deadline for comment. Of probably a physical mailing address will be included. But the website regulations.gov always has a portal for people to make their comments directly online if they want to.
Erin Bouvis from Western New England School of Law, thank you so much for walking us through the past, present, and potential future of Title IX.
My pleasure. You're welcome.
This is all of it. I'm Allison Stewart. Montreal's Just for Laughs Festival is one of the biggest comedy festivals in the world, with more than 2 million people attending each summer. Hasan Minhaj was a new face at the comedy festival in 2014. He now has his own Netflix show. Michelle Wolf was a new face in 2014. She went on to host the White House Correspondents' Dinner, work on The Daily Show, and had her own show on Netflix. Amy Schumer, new face 2007. Kevin Hart, new face 2001. You get the idea. The Montreal Just for Laughs Festival is very important in the world of comedy. And this Friday, Amazon Prime will release a new 6-part docuseries called Inside Jokes. And it follows a select group of comics as they go through the process of auditioning for the Montreal Just for Laughs New Faces Showcase. Joining us now from California is the director of Inside Jokes, Emmy-nominated filmmaker and entrepreneur Neil Berkeley. Hi, Neil.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks. And also joining us is Daphnique Spring. She is one of the 7 comedians followed on Inside Jokes. Hi, Daphnique.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. So, Neil, how did this idea originate to follow all of these comics?
It actually came last year. I just finished up. I put out a movie about Gilbert Gottfried, so I had followed a comic around for a while. And I got this idea, what it'd be like to follow a comedian as they prepare their set, their hour-long set. And I was talking to producer Jimmy Fox about that, and he had a similar idea. And one day he called me up. This is a true story. He called me up and said, hey, I think I just sold a show to Amazon about following comedians as they get ready for Montreal's Just for Laughs. And I told them, you're going to direct it. So literally 2 weeks later, we had a deal. A month later, we were in New York shooting. It happened that fast, just this idea of following comics around as they get their sets ready.
So you've been around comics a lot. What did you learn over the course of this docuseries? Because it's part documentary, part sort of a little bit of reality show, because they all want to get the same slot. What did you learn about comedy?
Yeah, I would say it's mostly documentary. The thing I always say is that the show just happens to be about comedians. It's really a very personal, very human story about people trying to make it. The thing I realized about comedy a long time ago, and the thing that I think people really love about comedy, is comedians are people that are just like us. Like, we all have problems. We all have things we go through. They just go on stage and they talk about it. So I think that's where humor and laughter and empathy are really what gravitate people to comedy. So it's a series of 6 stories about people that are going through things that we all go through in our normal lives. As they're trying to achieve the biggest dream of their career to date. It is mostly docuseries. There's some episodes that have just a little bit of stand-up comedy, mm-hmm. And some episodes that are all stand-up. But they are very human, very real stories. So, documentary series is a great way to put it.
Daphnique, you're very funny, but you are so serious about this. You are so serious about your comedy. Why are you so serious about it? Why are you so hardcore?
I'm so hardcore about it is because you give up so much to achieve your dream. You don't get to spend as much time with your family. I I can't start a family where I'm at right now. It's like I'm giving up marriage, kids, just like the American dream a little bit to achieve a bigger American dream. So that's why I take it so serious. I didn't come 3,000 miles to fail.
Dan, I think is a great example of what's great about the show is it shows how hard comedians actually work. You don't think of comics as working hard, but they don't get paid some nights. They do it for free. Sometimes they pay to do comedy. And we're seeing, like, imagine seeing Kevin Hart right before he became super famous. And we're seeing how hard they work to get to become who they are.
One of the reoccurring themes in the docuseries, at least in the first two episodes, we have the first two, is this idea that when you are, Definique, this is for you, when you're auditioning, you go up with 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, but for the big audition, it's got to be 6 minutes. And that extra minute or minute and a half is a really stressful thing for some of the comics to come up with. Tell us why it's stressful to go from like a tight 5 to a tight 6.
The reason why it's stressful to go from a tight 5 to a tight 6 is because you have to do that initial audition at the tight 5, and then you move on to the tight 6. So you don't know if that 1 minute could be the deciding factor of you not getting into Montreal because you did something that might have went a little left or too edgy, or they didn't catch on, or the crowd response wasn't that great, or the judges didn't like it. So it's really, people don't understand, a minute of just us talking may not seem critical, but in that moment, it's like, it's life or death. You know, death of your career or life for it to live on.
You know, you say in this one episode, you know, you have a degree in chemistry. You could have been a CEO. And I believe that after seeing your vision board, you show us that and your drive. Why did you give it all up? Is it something you just have to do?
I did actually intern at a pharmaceutical company. It was so boring. I was like, I can't sit here, even though I can have all the probably make a great living, you know what I mean? I was like, but I can't come here every single day of my life and just do paperwork and study dietary supplements. I feel like even though it's a lot of lows in the industry that I chose, stand-up comedy, it's a lot of lows. It's some highs, but I would say way more lows. I feel like I'm living life.
We're talking to Neil Berkley. He's the director of Inside Jokes, and Definique Spring. She is one of the comedians who's followed through this docuseries. So, Neil, as you watch this, you did this on the West Coast and on the East Coast. We have LA comics and New York comics. What are the similarities and what are the differences between the two?
Huge. It's striking differences. That's one of the things we talk about is where do you start your career? Because every comic has to choose New York or LA, I think. Mm-hmm. And the differences are huge. Like in New York, it's a grind. I mean, they go out and they can get to 4 or 5 shows a night sometimes, where in LA, you know, it's a driving city. So if you want to get up, and they go up every night, these comedians go up every night, sometimes 2-3 times a night. In LA, it's just a very different thing. Also in LA, I'd say more definitely, maybe you agree, more comics out here are going to be actors, they're going to be writers, they want to make TV shows, where in New York, it's solid comedy all the time, all stand up.
Yes, and New York is very solid. It's like, this is stand-up. I meet so many New York comics that are like, if I do acting, it's okay. But then in L.A., it's totally different because you have those actors that are at, they're not at a star level or even close to it yet. So their managers and agents persuade them to, you should do stand-up. I meet so many people every day. They're like, I'm a stand-up comedian, but I've never seen them do stand-up ever. I'm like, when was the last time you went up? Oh, like 2 months ago. But New York, when people say they're a stand-up comedian, they're getting up 2-3 nights a week. They're dedicated to it. It's a lifestyle there. Versus here, it's just a leisure, you know. Oh, I do stand-up. It sounds good.
It's so interesting, Definique, in the show as well, as you're a very beautiful woman, and you talk about sort of that evolution of how you presented yourself on stage. That used to kind of go out as a tomboy, but then you decided, you know what? No, I'm going to take the pretty with me. Why?
Because I started to take myself out of the mold that I had to belittle who I was in order for people to like me. So I decided to come out as the star I wanted to be and project myself of who I wanted to be and step out and embrace every part of me, whether it's beautiful, funny, smart, a whole lot of things incorporated. Why hide one aspect of who I am?
I also like that you talk about how these people have babysitters. They spent money on tickets. They go out of their way. So,
yes.
You know, look nice for them.
Well, when I was on the road and I feature for Cat Williams, Cat Williams explained that to me. He said, you have to understand this is an event for people. People pay for a babysitter. They get their hair done. They get a new outfit. They pregame, so they get drinks before. They go out to eat. They come here. They buy drinks. They pay for parking. They come in here. They don't want you to look like you just stepped off an open mic stage. You have to present yourself as someone that's dressed up, look nice, because these people, they want to laugh and they want to have a good time. And if they invested so much time in how they look, why should I come out looking any kind of way?
The name of the show is Inside Jokes. It's a hard look at comedy and what it takes to make it. It airs on Amazon Prime starting on November 30th. Neil Berkley and Daphne Springs, thanks so much for joining us. Congratulations on the series.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We'll meet you back here next time.